Next session, 32589. Reel 1.
Right. Leslie Wensby at Reel 1.
Christmas Day in the line at the in the Yongdong position started with gunfire, which is the Royal Artillery tradition of the senior NCOs going round with a mug of tea to all the soldiers. And at least in the intelligence and sniper section, the two sergeants respected this tradition and came round and woke all of us up that were in our hooches at that time. Being in the front line, although we were in a quiet position, it meant the same army routines had to be followed, but we didn't stand to at first light at battalion headquarters because we were three hills back from the forward positions. And there was 2 or 3 kilometres of Samichon floodplain in front of us before we reached the hills occupied by the Chinese. And although one position on the left was the Hook salient, from which it was possible to see two of the bridges that supplied us across the River Imjin, and hence this was vital ground. And three times while I was there, the Chinese tried to take that hilltop position, first against the US Marines, secondly against the Black Watch when we first arrived in November, and later in May 52 against us when our turn came to occupy that that hill. The routines were practiced assembling the patrol action reports from the night before and summarizing them and putting them into the command post for the battle adjutant. Perhaps I should explain that in the intelligence section, the main job of the section is to service the battalion command post, keep the maps up to date, keep the situation reports collated and prepared to go up to the higher echelons, and so on. And at that time, I was a private soldier, national serviceman, with only a month's experience in Korea in that position, and very much a sprog soldier. I was the only one trained in infantry intelligence activity, however, because my two colleagues were drafted in from rifle companies as soon as we got to Yongdong, and so the three of us ran a scratch team 24 hours to service the battalion headquarters. But it turned out that apart from the sergeant who arrived a bit later, the other two hadn't any map marking skills and couldn't handle the code and cipher work, so I ended up doing all these things, and gradually became number two to the intelligence officer, who was Lieutenant Rodney Harms, and his job was to go out with the CO to on recces and on to O groups, and he was away from the office most of the time. The office, of course, was just a hole in the ground like the command post, with some timbers over the top and a sort of trench-like tunnel, not fully overhead covered anyway. But it was our base for the 2 months that we were on Yongdong. About having collated the situation reports overnight from rifle companies and written a summary and put them in for the battle adjutant, CO, and 2IC who operated out of the command post. My next job was to exchange patrol reports with the neighbouring units. on our left flank was another unit in our brigade. On our right flank was another brigade, which unit. And I think about that time it would be the Durham Light Infantry. I went off in the IO. He's the intelligence officer. The IO's jeep, because he'd gone with the CO, and his driver was a chap I knew named Jenny. That's his surname. He was an ex-Green Howard, as I was. But he'd done a 3-year Python in the Malayan jungle with the 1st Battalion of the Green Howards. And was an experienced soldier who didn't fancy being in a rifle company, but enjoyed driving a jeep and taking the IO around the area. So we went off and delivered our patrol reports, but I seem to remember that it was probably the US Marines holding that position, which was on the other side of the Samichon, which was a tributary of the Imjin, running into the north bank of the Imjin, which flows roughly northeast to southwest to come out on the coast at Incheon. I remember from the incident that followed later, when I was crawling up a vehicle track and cracking bars of chocolate with my knees as I crawled, that we'd got this on the side of the jeep, which had no sides on it. It was just the type with a canvas hood and open sides. We went off to the Marines, which was a routine thing for me, and they had more food and more goodies than we had, and they were very generous. And we piled them up on the metal mud guards on the back seat, but just held it. And they were loose bars, a dozen. And I put them behind me on the passenger side. However, we were coming back, and I think we'd had a drink, although the Marines were officially dry, and we had a bottle of beer a day, and we'd taken a few bottles to hand over, which got swapped for the chocolate, I suppose. But these were thin 4-ounce bars of chocolate. And we were coming back, and we might have been singing. We were certainly in a light-hearted, merry mood. When we were going slightly downhill, and there'd been some rain, and the road was wet. And it was quite cold. We were well wrapped up in this open jeep. When the Centurion tank came round the corner and blocked the track, which of course wasn't metalled at all, it was just a rough track. And here we were doing about 20-25 miles an hour going downhill with this tank blocking the road. And Jenny had no choice. He tried to brake, but it skidded. And we were off the road before we knew what was happening. He got past the tank and was going down the hill on a slope which I suppose was about less than 45 degrees, but bouncing about all over the place, and with a minefield at the bottom, the bottom being about 70 yards off the road. Partly being thrown and partly with a sense of self-preservation, I rolled out of my open door and left him to it, and crawled back up the track on my knees and this is where I crawled on the chocolate bars, with the tank crew with their hatches open and some of them sitting half out, jeering and laughing at us. I sort of was crawling as fast as I could, expecting to hear an explosion any moment, and it didn't happen. And the next thing I heard was a voice behind me saying, "Hey, Wincy, come and help me push this thing out." And I sort of sat up and looked back, and he'd had the composure to choose a steel picket to stop the run of the jeep, the minefield was supported by an apron fence, not Dannet, not the coiled wire, but which had pickets about every 5 yards and a triangle of wire, which were difficult to cross on foot for a soldier. And so it was, and that was on the, if you like, the blue side of the minefield. And he'd run into this, and He, at that stage, the engine had stalled and he hadn't got it going again. It's probably, but when I got down to him and the tank drove off, he was, he'd actually got it started, and with a bit of help from me pushing on the side that was oblique into the wire where I could get at it, and he got it into four-wheel drive, and we drove back a bit to our own tracks. Explained the broken chocolate bars to our colleagues as best we could. I don't remember him telling anybody about the incident, because by and large little gossipy things like that only stayed within the knowledge of small circles. And when it was all over, of course, he said, well, this sort of thing could only happen on Christmas Day, I suppose. But at least our luck was in. But luck being very important to a frontline soldier. Anyway, that that describes that Christmas Day. There's a slight sequel to it. There was some attempt at a Christmas dinner at lunchtime. But we'd missed that, being out visiting. But the whole... we left the line at the end of February. At the end of January. So that would be 25th of December. We were in for 2 months, the whole of December and January at Yeongdong. And we came out into Divisional Reserve back at... behind the divisional headquarters to take up a new position. I think we were changing with one of the other brigades. And we had our Christmas dinner on the 5th of February in reserve, and the whole battalion had a Christmas dinner. And I volunteered for duty in the Int office, which was a marquee. And I was relieved to go for my lunch. We had a telephone in there, of course, and that sort of virtually covered the command post situation while we were in reserve. And I remember going for breakfast that morning in this very cold open plain about 50 miles south of our original position. And when they broke the eggs to fry me an egg for breakfast, because I think I was behind everybody else, having been relieved for a late breakfast, it was solid, and it melted first and then fried, which indicates temperatures. And the battle adjutant, Major Tony Firth, had given a bottle of sherry as a Christmas present to me and the intelligence section, and as they came to relieve me for meals, they each had a swig of this morning and lunchtime. But I'm afraid by 4 o'clock it had all gone, I was enjoying my Christmas Day a little better by then, on the 5th of February. So that covers the Christmas situation.
Did you have anything in the way of Red Cross parcels or Goodwill parcels from?
Not Red Cross. I discovered that the officers' mess was having Keeler's Dundee marmalade flown in. And now the officers' mess didn't exist. It was back in B echelon, which was A echelon was the ammunition dump, which was not always manned, and B echelon was where the quartermaster looked after the stores. But I rumour had got around that soldiers could have parcels flown out free for the post office, by the post office, and they were coming out by a special plane, which was the predecessor of the Concorde, I think, which was, it was a, I think, Comet, actually, may have been. Anyway, I wrote to my mother and said, would she send out every week a bottle of Rose's lime juice cordial, and every month one of her fruitcakes, which used to come in a biscuit tin, flat, you know, this sort of size. And there were times when I'd get back from being up in a rifle company position during the day, and one of the lads would be outside on the hill washing or doing something. He'd say, you've got a parcel, because they all knew that when I got back, I'd cut it up and share it out, and it was a great treat. It's a mug of tea and a piece of homemade fruitcake. So the bottle of beer was a sort of goodwill gesture from somewhere, but we didn't get food parcels as such. We lived on rations. Rations could be were on the whole good, but our way of life was such that we missed a lot of meals and we were always hungry. But it was better when we got on to K rations, the American rations, because we'd be allocated so many days' ration boxes for my section, and we could handle it ourselves, and then we didn't lose the food if we missed a meal, sort of thing. And I got in the habit of putting a small tin of diced fruit in the pocket of my combat jacket as an iron ration in reserve, because you always had a little tin opener, that was very useful. But I came across one several months later, actually. I came across a ration situation in an isolated platoon which was on the other side of the Samichon. By that time we were on the Hook reserve position before we actually occupied the Hook. And this platoon was living on steak and kidney pudding. And what had happened was that the company colour sergeant was sort of dumping his spare rations on them because they were furthest out, and the rations vehicle had to cross open ground, which could be fired on. And so they probably delivered them by jeep quickly in and out. And so these lads were, and it was my old rifle company, which I'd been in Germany, Charlie Company. And so the next time I was up front, I asked to see the company commander, my old company commander. And I said I felt sure that he wanted to know that his men were being pretty badly looked after. And it got put right. But I mean, that was just a bad administration.
How palatable did you find the cave rations?
They were unusual. I mean, my hoochie mate, who was an ex-wartime soldier who'd been a prisoner of war in Germany, he liked ham and lima beans. The lima bean is a big broad bean, about four times as big, flat and white, and the ham was a bit like Spam, but it was he liked those. I wasn't too keen. They had a sort of steak and kidney pudding, but on the whole, they were better than cookhouse food, because a rifle company has only one cook and 150 men, and those 150 men in a forward position might be 500 yards from one to the other, and they used to come for their rations, their meals, and take them in small hay boxes and so on, but cooked on a petrol burner, and the rations weren't very good. The food wasn't really very good. It was just verging towards poor, I would say. In my territorial days later, I did a messing officer's course when I was with the Hallamshires. I went to the ordnance factory at Nottingham, and then years later, when I was in the medical corps on another exercise in Germany, I was asked to go early by I was with a general hospital, 10th London General Hospital, which is where I met my wife Shirley. She was a medical officer, and I was asked to go early with the parachute field ambulance, whose CEO, a dentist, I knew on a social basis, and they'd had trouble in balancing their ration account and admittedly lived very badly, and they'd heard that I was fairly clued up on catering as a quartermaster. So by that time I was a quartermaster, having gone through the ranks. I found that I couldn't make up from the rations a three-course meal for each of three meals, which I used to try to do. I set up a system where they could balance their ration account, which was really very simple. They had to put somebody on the gate, and he had to check the names of everybody going in and everybody going out in every vehicle. I said, you must do this because you must have the haversack ration supplement for everybody going out and for everybody coming in. And this will make, it's a monetary value, and it will make all the difference in balancing your books, which it did. But when I got back to the headquarters for my proper job, which was, I was the medical staff officer for the logistical supply group for the United Kingdom Mobile Force, which was a division intended to be very mobile, and we used to go to Denmark as well as Germany, which was called the northern option for the deployment of that force. And I spoke to the Ordnance Corps regular army staff officer who looked after food, and I told him about this, and he said, well, could you write out the menu that you've planned and demonstrate this point, which I did. He said, right. He said, we'll send this off to the War Office in London, and signaled it to the next night. Yes, we were both on night duty. And it came back, and we were on about 4 marks a day ration allowance at that time. It was on a monetary basis. And they put it up another mark, which was 50%, because we were all on petrol burner cooking and so on. And it made all the difference in the world to all the units in the exercise. And it came 3 days late, but was backdated. And it meant that they could live so much better, because they could buy supplements in the German supermarkets and live better. So I was heartened at the fact that the system could be made to work if you were plugged into the right communication channels. But food in Korea was very basic and bordering on the inadequate.
Did that have any consequences in terms of the soldiers' morale and health at all?
I don't think so. I think it was the rifle companies, which were static, were better organized than we were. I mean, the headquarters had a signals platoon and an MT platoon. And the signalers were all on shifts. Some of them were up in the rifle companies. The drivers were always out or bringing. And it was the spasmodic nature of the missing meals that I came back from an all-day lie-up once with my mate Seymour, who was in the sniper section, and I went out to sniper because I was a good shot as well. And we went out at 4 o'clock in the morning, before it was daylight, to be in position in no man's land before it got daylight. And we didn't get back till 8 o'clock at night. And we'd had, apart from, I think we'd had took a bit of bread with us, or maybe a sandwich. We were camouflaged up in no man's land, and we didn't move much. And When we got back to the cookhouse, the cook said, nobody told me you were going to be late. He said, I haven't kept anything back. He said, I said, well, what do you got? He said, all I've got is this cabbage. And it was chewed cabbage. We each filled our large mess tin. Mine would hold about, heaped it up about 2 pounds, and shoveled it down. And that was all the food we got that day. But I don't think we blamed anybody. It was just, you know, it was just the fortunes of war, I think. But that wasn't the greatest deprivation. The greatest deprivation was lack of sleep. I got into the habit of sleeping about 4 hours a day, mostly between breakfast and lunchtime, because the night was when it all happened. And our situation was such that if any code, I became the sort of code and cipher expert, and nobody else. The sergeant could decode, but he didn't very often because he didn't. He was afraid of making mistakes, and one of the problems with the American AFSAL code was that there were alternatives, and. I took the trouble early on to ring up the cipher clerk in the divisional headquarters, which produced most of these messages, and we agreed that where there were alternatives, we'd use the second alternative. So I knew if he'd done that, and I think the word went round at that end as well, probably, and so I would have one word in there, but somebody else could decode it. I might have another word. Once later on, we had a message decoded by the assistant signals officer, which caused a bit of a problem because of misunderstandings. And I was told off for decoding a message wrongly when it turned out that he'd decoded it. And it was simply a question of the alternatives. When I sort of changed a few of his words, it made a bit of difference. I don't think these deficiencies affected morale at all. These were. I remember the CO saying afterwards, because I at night I'd be coming and going in the command post, I'd hear things that the senior officer was saying to each other. And I remember him hearing him say to the general once, I'm very pleased with the way the D Company in particular on the Hook salient coped with the 5 days of shelling before the Chinese attack. He said, and I've tried to work out an explanation for this, and I can only think that some of these lads from Leeds and Huddersfield suffered bombing during the war, and they knew what it was all about, and it didn't bother them too much.